like to welcome you to the, I think it's the second of the IBRI colloquia this fall session, and the last before January or February. We're happy to have with us this evening one of our IBRI fellows and board members, Dr. David C. Bossert, to speak to us on the subject of abundant life, diversity of life, and the biosphere. Dr. Bossert did his undergraduate work at Drexel, got his PhD in mathematics at Dartmouth, worked as a systems analyst for many, many years, own firm, I think, but with a lot of government money funding the operation, and retired a few years ago, and has been spending a lot of time thinking about the whole question of origins, starting all the way back with creation of matter and working up. And this is the last in the series. One more after this.
Well, one wraps it up in more.
Okay, one wraps it up. He's doing a 7-part series here that's been scattered over several years on this subject. So,
thank you. This is going to be a jam-packed talk. We have some trilobites over there you can look at. We're going to talk about some trilobites afterwards. And they're provided by Dr. Rilling, who is joining us tonight. And I also have a extended slideshow of radiolarian skeletons, which we'll do after the talk. So anybody interested in that, we'll continue with that. But the talk itself is long. So 62 minutes was my last calculation. I hope you don't leave today totally bewildered, even though there are maybe some things you don't fully understand. I don't fully understand everything we will touch on tonight. There are some times that I feel as if I am opening a great door of understanding, a door that is only yet open a crack. But even the view through that small opening hints at wonderful things yet to be seen and understood. There are lots and lots of things we don't yet know about how God went about his creative work. But God has designed the natural world in such a way that his work leaves traces that can be revealed by hard, honest, scientific study. He did not have to do this, and we should give him praise and thanks for this revealing design. We will see some remarkable examples later in this talk. Despite the amazing advances of science in the past few decades, and they are truly amazing, there still are far more things we don't know than we do. In the course of preparing this talk, I read a great work by Ernst Haeckel, written in the 1880s. As I read it and noted how he sometimes passed over details that would in later years be seen as important, and so was led in some false directions, I am reminded that where we are today may likewise seem as incomplete and primitive 100 years from now. I know that some creationists focus on Haeckel's errors, but I see him as a great scientist in the true sense of the word. He was a pioneer, charting out a great new wilderness, and he did his scientific work honestly and with great skill, as far as his available tools would allow. In our remarks about the creation of plants and animals, as Haeckel did, I may be tempted to make a few speculative comments. I hope you will not hold it against me if I turn out to be wrong in a thing or two. That's the nature of science, after all. There's a question, I call it the nonsense question, that hangs around in the back of my mind. The question is this: what are the limits to natural development? I call it nonsense in quotes because a scientist who believes that everything we see today came about by random, undirected processes will say, probably with a dismissing air of superiority, that there are no limits to natural development other than limits that are opposed by physical and chemical considerations. For example, you can't have humans 20 feet tall, for good physical reasons having to do with the ability to support and supply such a body. But for me, as one who believes in God's direct creative activity, but at the same time understands there are a lot of natural changes that constantly occur within species lines, the question is very real. I want to know where in the creation of life God allowed natural processes to rule and where he had to step in. I believe he did have to step in, because I believe there are certain developments that are so complex and require such careful orchestration of events that natural processes left to themselves would never come up with the necessary results, unless, of course, you credit nature with godlike qualities. An example is the original creation of bacterial life nearly 4 billion years ago, a subject discussed in my last talk. which Bart promises me will be on the web before too long. So the question is very intriguing to me. What are the limits of natural development? When God ordered his creatures to reproduce after their kind, what are the limits of kind? Could a single kind produce lions, tigers, and kitties? That is, by legitimately producing after its kind by natural processes. Suppose within this group some remarkable biological innovations are found. How about hippos and horses, or cows and camels? Just to look ahead a bit, I think that an answer to this nonsense question will have some real surprises. The reason is simple. The issue of kind is a genetic one, buried in the genes. But the only way that we have been able to study kinds in the past has been by looking at the physical appearance, the morphology, to use a technical term. That is one of the limitations that Haeckel faced a century ago, since he worked a long time before modern discoveries in genetics. We have all experienced times when two things look alike, but are entirely unrelated. And we've also experienced the converse. Perhaps when we understand the genetics more fully, we will have to rearrange our notions of relatedness, both creationists and secular scientists. So that you may be able to get a sense of where we're heading, here's an outline of the talk.
You're already there. Ahead of me?
Oh, yeah, you're probably there. Okay, we will first talk about the Cambrian explosion, which is the first time that animals show up in the fossil record about 550 to 600 million years ago. Next, we will give a quick overview of when the fossil plants and animals show up. Then we'll return to the nonsense question, using the examples of radiolarians and trilobites to fuel the discussion. Both have a very long fossil history. Finally, we will wrap up with some conclusions and a mention of Michael Denton's conjecture about abundant life, which inspired the title of this talk. I won't say much in this talk about how we determine the age of fossils. There are numerous independent and overlapping ways to date fossils and geological formations. They tell a consistent story, and I see no reason to dispute them. If this makes you unhappy, I'm sorry, but that's another talk. In the last talk, I discussed radioactive dating, but this is only one of many ways to date rocks and fossils. Some methods can even measure the length of the solar year and the lunar month, with the result that it's known that in the Cambrian age, there were about 415 days in a year. The Earth rotated faster then, and a lunar month was about 31 and a half days long. The moon was closer then. And I'm sorely tempted to go into some of those things about dating, but no time. In the last talk, A Fit Place for Life, we discussed the preparation of the environment for the arrival of plants and animals. This preparation took about 3 billion years, bringing Earth's history to about 600 million years ago, where this talk picks up. The preparation included an oxygen atmosphere and a broad distribution of available nitrogen and other organic food that is needed by all advanced life. The only missing piece in this preparation is the protection of dry land from solar and cosmic radiation. This is done by the ozone layer, which was slowly being built up, but would not be fully in place for another 300 million years. In the last talk, we noted two clear instances of God's direct creative activity. First, in the initial creation of bacterial life. Second, in the creation of vastly more complex eukaryotic life, that's life with nucleus in the cell, about 1,800 million years ago. Think of amoebas and slipper-shaped paramecians, for example. At the point where we begin today, marine life is possible after the long buildup of the needed nutrients, but only bacteria can survive on dry land. Starting about a billion years ago, bacteria are at their task of spreading nutrients on dry land for the future arrival of plants and animals. Complex life on dry land is still impossible because of radiation from the sun and outer space. Bacteria can survive on land because they reproduce rapidly, and their genetic makeup is less vulnerable to random destruction of the genetic information. And indeed, damaged bacteria also contribute food to the survivors. Next slide. The animal kingdom appeared suddenly in the fossil record shortly after 600 million years ago, and what has come to be called the Cambrian explosion. The boundary that defines the start of the Cambrian age is the appearance of fossil burrows that were obviously made by a complex animal, probably an arthropod, The name means jointed feet. Think of a lobster. We will meet trilobites, a kind of arthropod, in a minute. The beginning of the Cambrian Age is currently set about 590 million years ago and marks the start of the Phanerozoic era. That means visible animals, ones that are visible to the unaided eye. Next slide. One of the earliest actual animal fossils is a trilobite, an arthropod that appears suddenly in the fossil record about 570 million years ago. You can see this one is a small one compared with a dime there. To give a flavor of what I mean by sudden, here is a quote from one author. Fossils of trilobites appear suddenly in the geological record. If you're tempted by the word dramatic, then this is the occasion where you could be forgiven for weakening. When you visit a rock section spanning the right bit of the early Cambrian, and there are such profiles in Newfoundland, Mongolia, and Siberia, there will be not a sniff of a trilobite as you work your way upward from one bed to the successor. Then quite suddenly, a whole Prophyllotopsis, or Elionellus, probably pronounced this terribly, as big as a crab, will pop out into your waiting hands as you split the rock. These are trilobites with lots of segments and big eyes, striking things, not little squiddy objects. You're tempted to cry out, bang! And as you continue to collect a foot or so higher into the younger strata, the first trilobite will be joined by others, maybe a half dozen or so just different species, all individually distinctive ones. Next slide. The Cambrian Age is the first appearance of animals. To this point, we have been talking about plants and animals as if the meaning is obvious, but even biologists still argue about the precise meaning of the words. For our purposes, I would like to use a definition that will suit our purposes, though it may not satisfy everyone. For our purposes, all plants, the kingdom Plantae, and animals, kingdom Animalia, have many cells, reproduce sexually with sperm and egg, and develop from embryos. This definition eliminates all bacteria and single-celled creatures and fungi, which make up the kingdom's bacteria, Protista, and fungi, hence the title of Lynn Margulis' book, Five Kingdoms, which is a survey of all the animal phyla. You can immediately guess that the arrival of plants and animals was a phenomenal jump in complexity, easily comparable to the jump that occurred with the creation of the first cell with a nucleus. An outstanding feature that distinguishes animals from plants is in the basic way that the embryos develop. All living cells have a way to turn particular genes on and off. This is done with proteins that are produced by a group of genes called the homeobox genes. Animals have, in addition to this, other genes called the homeotic genes. These are genes that orient the body so that the development proceeds differently in different parts of the body, even in different parts of an individual cell, particularly in the early stages of the embryo. Genes that are both homeobox and homeotic are called Hox genes. Animals have Hox genes. They turn genes on and off and distinguish different regions of gene development. The Hox genes are responsible for the visible complexity and symmetry expressed in animals. So in animals, there is a genetic body plan that distinguishes, in the general case, front and back, top and bottom, left and right. One of the crazy types of experimentation done today is to mix this up and rearrange where the various Hox genes get expressed. The result is legs where antennas should be, eyes and armpits, and so on. That's intended to be humorous there. You can immediately guess that the emergence of animal body plans represents a further phenomenal jump in complexity. Consider each of the unifying themes of plants and animals. The invention of sex, specifically a new way of cell division called meiosis, to complement mitosis, which is the way bacteria and single-celled eukaryotes divide. Secondly, the embryo and embryonic development and the creation of the apparatus involved in forming body plans. And third, the creation of structural and functional systems, roots, stems, leaves, vascular systems for plants, and for animals, the sensory, nervous, digestive, muscular, and other systems. All told, these require such a remarkable level of innovation that it's impossible for me to even begin to imagine a random, undirected way that such innovation could come about. The complex orchestration to achieve these innovations is beyond description. Lynn Margulis, that's the author of this book, Five Kingdoms, divides the animal kingdom into 37 phyla, labeled A1 to A37. The phyla are the various body plans, and every one of them, with a possible quibble about the last one, suddenly appeared in the Cambrian explosion. About half of the phyla are worms of some sort, which I suppose are of great interest to biologists. But here are the ones that are most familiar to us that are found among the Cambrian fossils. You have sponges, the porifera. You have the nettle, the nidaria, corals, and so forth. Rotifera, chelicerata, that's the scorpion spiders. Mandibulata, chewing jaws, termites, insects, so forth and so on. And all of those are represented in the Cambrian explosion. Some claim that they all show up within a period of 5 million years, about 545 million years ago. I don't quite agree with that the evidence shows this, since we keep finding earlier and earlier examples of animal fossils, such as the early trilobite that we already mentioned. But it seems pretty clear that the animal kingdom, for practical purposes, showed up in one geological instant. Here's a collage of some of the Cambrian animals and fossils that were found in the Burgess Shale Formation. I have a book about that, too, if you're interested in looking at it later on. Originally published in Scientific American. The Burgess Shale is mid-Cambrian, about 445 million years ago, and until recently was one of the most intensively studied sites from the Cambrian era. I think, though, that currently more active interest is going on in Chenggang in China and the sites in Mongolia and Greenland, which are about 30 million years earlier. On the Internet, you can find illustrated catalogs of Cambrian fossils for sale, very high price, in my opinion, especially from the China site. The quibble I mentioned is about Pikaia, a possible example of A37. It's floating around over here, which appears to have segmented vertebra, but no clear evidence of a brain as such. Personally, I'm inclined to place the first appearance of craniata a bit later. If you follow the usual arguments of natural evolution, you might think that the various phyla would appear in the fossil record in roughly the order of complexity of the body plan. You might expect, for example, that sponges, which have no definite digestive gut, and corals or hydras, which have a relatively simple blind gut, would show up before animals that have a fully developed digestive system. But that's not the case. In fact, the trilobites, which have essentially all the vital systems, nerves, sensors, circulation, muscular, and full digestive system, are among the earliest to appear in the fossil record. Trilobites show up suddenly, without any obvious predecessor, among the logical body plans that one might expect to precede them. In fact, there is no clear order of first appearance in the geological record, certainly not any order that could be used to imply that one body plan is the ancestor of the other. To a certain extent, the accidental nature of fossil discoveries might explain away some of this mixing of first arrivals, but it's hard to explain away the total lack of order. Not only do the phyla show up in no clear order, but they show up with the most complex imaginable body plans. Here's an electron micrograph of a Cambrian bivalve crustacean. Bivalve means it has two shells. For this particular phyla, they're not symmetric. You have some shells that are very symmetric, but these are not. Many details can be identified, including legs, claws, and gills. Shortly, we will see even more extensive detail in trilobite fossils. These elaborate animals show up suddenly with no obvious fossil predecessors. It's probably unnecessary to note that the first animals had only bacteria and minute organic waste for food. Even the largest and most imposing of these animals, the trilobites, only ate such food. At first, they probably had no natural enemies, so have you noticed a curious thing? Both the trilobite, shown earlier, and the crustacean, shown here, have significant protective armor surrounding the soft body parts, and this is at a time when there were no predators. Clearly, the body plan anticipates the future need for protection. Isn't that curious? It doesn't seem to follow the dictates of natural evolution. Why have armor if there are no predators? Predators come later, particularly if the armor itself has some liabilities, such as restrictions on growth. When predators do show up, the armor may have some useful function. It would seem that these animals anticipate a need that was not present when they first appeared. We will see another striking example later on in the talk. Next strike. The Cambrian is the first of a series, look at the left side now, is the first of a series of geological ages which record the creation of plants and animals and the migration from the sea to dry land. Here the ages are listed with the present at the top and the Cambrian, the oldest, at the bottom. The ages are distinguished by types of fossils found. The boundaries between ages are marked by various global events. The two most dramatic boundary events were mass extinctions, the Permian extinction about 250 million years ago, and the Cretaceous or KT extinction about 65 million years ago. You know that KT extinction is the time that dinosaurs were wiped out. This extinction occurred when a huge meteorite hit the Earth in the vicinity of the Yucatan Peninsula in western Gulf of Mexico. It's less certain what caused the Permian extinction, possibly another meteor impact, or possibly Earth cooling in a massive ice age. To the right of the slide, we see the moving to land by plants, which began seriously about 470 million years ago, some 100 million years after the Cambrian explosion. By this time, corals and mollusks and other sea creatures are long established. Some early fungi appear about 500 million years ago, mosses about 470, both in the Ordovician era. These all lack real roots, so they can only be small and only grow in water or wet surroundings. However, they could move from shorelines to the interior of land masses, provided the necessary bacteria had preceded them to supply food and nitrogen, because they have the ability to go into a dormant state during dry periods. The ability to survive extreme environments goes all the way back to the very first life, if you recall from our last talk about cyanobacteria being able to form aconites, I think we call them, I'm trying to think of a word, the ability to go be dormant. Cosmic and solar radiation at this time was still severe. But for these simple plants, that was only an inconvenience, because every plant zapped by radiation became food for other plants. As long as the reproduction could keep ahead of the destruction, they were able to cope. The really serious issue was water, more precisely the retention of water in the plants that were exposed to dry land and air. By the start of the Silurian age, 430 million years ago, the algae and mosses appear with waxy coats that prevent drying out. And from this point, they spread all over the dry land. The waxy coating is characteristic of all land plants from this time on. Club mosses show up around 420 million years ago. They are the first fossils that have roots in a vascular system to transport dissolved minerals and water between the roots and the rest of the plant. At the same time, spores, which protect plant embryos in damp environments, appear. Club mosses are common and can easily be found in woodlands at the base of trees and other damp places. If you go into a spruce woods or something like that, a lot of the ground cover will be club mosses and that sort of thing. It's difficult to overstate the marvelous creative innovations that these roots, vascula, and spores represent. The vascular system, for example, includes two separate parts called the xylem and the phloem for transporting food to and from the main part of the body. Flow depends on capillary action and the control of concentration of dissolved material in the cells so that osmotic pressure will cause water and solutes to move against gravity. Osmotic pressure causes water movement towards cells that have higher concentrations of dissolved material. Osmotic pressure also maintains the shape and rigidity of plants. Another innovation is the specialization of different parts of this plant for mineral absorption, that's the roots, and food production. Ferns appear next, about 400 million years ago. Ferns have large leaves with a web of veins, an improvement over club mosses. Early fern trees and conifers appear about 50 million years later, early in the Carboniferous age, about 370 million years ago. Up to the mid-Carboniferous, all the plants lived in swamps and very wet environments because they do not have true roots and woody stems. This early part is called the Mississippian era. The latter half of the Carboniferous age, when true roots are created, is the Pennsylvanian. The Carboniferous age is a time when many of the great coal deposits were made. Note that these deposits removed a lot of carbon from the environment. Note also that there were no large land animals to feed on the plant life, so that full ecological recycling did not take place. The next stage was the creation of two things almost simultaneously. winged instruments and true winged insects and true seed plants. These show up in the fossil record at the end of the Pennsylvanian or start of the Permian age about 300 million years ago. True seed plants are distinguished from spore-bearing plants by the fact that the seeds have true embryos, food, and a hard coating around the seed for protection. This was the first time that land plants had the ability to spread throughout dry land and were no longer tied to swamps or wet areas. This is also the first time that the ozone layer is completely in place and allowed plants to survive on dry land by shielding the land from solar and cosmic radiation. So in fact, seed plants, the first true dry plants, were created as soon as survival on dry land was possible. A little later, beetles appear in the fossil record. After all, you have to have something to chew the plants. We don't have time to do it, but beetles make a great study of the limits of species variation. As someone said, God must love the beetles, there are so many of them. There was another mass extinction around 255 million years ago, the Permian extinction, in which 85% of all species of plants and animals die out. I don't think the cause of this extinction is fully known, but it seems likely it was a result of a large meteor hitting the Earth, which might cause a dense cloud of debris that would hide the sun for a period up to several years. After the Permian extinction, modern plants appear. Modern ferns, about 255 million years ago, fruiting plants, about 200 million, and the most abundant modern plant species, the angiosperms, or flowering plants, about 170 million. With these changes, plants could spread all over the dry land. The arrival of angiosperms is announced in the fossil record by pollen grains. Actual fossils of flowering plants start appearing about 40 million years later. This is the overall story of the creation of plants. We have left out the most interesting part, a detailed discussion of all the marvelous innovations involved in this creation. Each stage involved ingenious solutions to very difficult problems. Here are some of them. How to propagate and survive in extreme conditions. How to avoid drying out in the atmosphere. How to get water and nutrients to plant extremities. How to support weight and air and maintain rigid form. Next slide. I would like to now give a quick overview of the creation of land animals, as I did for land plants. We already mentioned the creation of all the basic body plans in the Cambrian explosion. After the Cambrian, a number of classes of one phylum, the Craniata, show up. In my view, all or at least many of these separate classes are distinct creative acts rather than natural development from a common ancestor, mostly because I can't fathom how the major innovations would arise naturally. After the Cambrian explosion, the first jawless fish showed up around 450 million years ago, complete with a protected spinal cord and cranium. In my view, this is the first proper evidence of the phylum Craniata, which includes most of the land animals you're familiar with. Jawed fish appear a little later, about 390 million years ago, including the coelacanth, a living fossil that long was thought extinct until it was fished up in Madagascar in the 1940s. By this time, very elaborate embryonic developments are well in place, including both internal and external development of the embryos. Note, for example, that coelacanths are among the earliest examples of jawed bony fish, and they give live birth. Most fish spawn, and the embryos develop out in the water. But the coelacanth, which is one of the most ancient fish, actually gives live birth, which is kind of interesting because, you know, I don't know whether, you know, I don't know enough about this stuff, but whether that it actually is called, would be called a placental animal or not, because I don't know how it gives live birth, but, you know, whether it uses the full mechanisms of the placenta and so forth, I don't know. I presume it does, but I don't know enough about that kind of stuff. But anyway, it seems kind of ironic that the earliest living example of a fish already gives birth live. In the Devonian age, the first big move toward land animals occurs about the same time as the first big marine animals. First land animals are amphibians. Think of some salamanders and frogs later. Amphibians are tied to water because fertilization in the early development stages take place in water, much as most fish do. Think of tadpoles. Winged insects arrive around 340 million years. This time marks another step in the move to dry land, as up to this time, life poked its head out of water only in swamps and marshes with lots of water nearby. Of course, many of the winged insects still need water, or at least moist environments, for the larval stage. Reptiles are the first real land animals that fertilize internally and give birth alive, placental birth, or else have fully developed eggs with protective features such as a hard shell and an initial food supply. They show up around 300 million years ago and are the first animals that can truly live on dry land without being tied to swamps and bodies of water. Note again the coincidence that they arrive at the first time that the ozone layer allows complex animal and plant life on dry land. So both plants and animals appear on dry land, or are capable of appearing on dry land, at almost the same time that the ozone layer is completely in place and is able to support us. Thought that was kind of an interesting coincidence. After the Permian extinction, 250 billion years ago, some of the modern plants and animals were created. No large plant and land animals survived, but some large fish, such as the sulcanth, did. Mammals show up around 220 million years ago. Birds show up in the Jurassic 160 million years ago, about the same time as modern flowering plants. So you have birds and flowering plants about the same time. Birds came about after a number of innovations, feathers, of course, but also special lungs, heart, bones, and other features. From this point, the land animals really take off, with animals and plants arriving in great profusion. While this has been a ridiculously fast sweep through the timeline of the creation of plants and animals, what's missing is a careful discussion of all the marvelous innovations required. Even very minor features display marvelous complexity. Take, for example, the design of the stingers found in corals and jellyfish, which appeared in the Cambrian. The nadaria, or stingers, they can be absolute marvels. I mean, I enjoy engineering investigations anyway. And if you look at the many ways that stingers are made, I mean, you might not like the stingers, but they sure are marvels of engineering. Next slide. I would like to go back to the nonsense question now and probe the variations within a kind and what they might look like. Specifically, I would like to look at two kinds of life that have very long fossil records. The first example is radiolarians, which are single-celled creatures, and the second example is a trilobite. Both creatures show up early in the Cambrian age. Radiolarians are still abundant today. The trilobites disappeared at 250 million years ago. Radiolarians are found in the oceans worldwide. They are a variety of plankton, which means they are free-floating. Many varieties are phosphorescent and cause a familiar glow in a ship's wake. They are distinguished by the fact that they usually have a hard shell that surrounds the cell nucleus in reproductive processes. The shell typically has many holes in it through which jelly-like pseudopods project to gather food. And just yesterday, I had a discussion with a friend of my sister-in-law's husband from California. They were visiting us, asking, why do they have a hard skeleton? A single-celled animal with a hard skeleton, why? I have no idea. It hardly is protection because, you know, a lot of the fossils have their bellies stuffed with these radiolarian skeletons, so it obviously does not keep them from being eaten. Next slide. There are many thousands of varieties of radiolarians. Just put that one up and then put up the next one. The biologist Ernst Haeckel, who was a contemporary with Darwin, produced a three-volume systematic study of radiolarians in 1887 in connection with a three-year biological expedition of HMS Challenger conducted during 1872 to 75. Included in the study are 140 plates that show thousands of different radiolarian skeletons, a few of which are shown here. After the close of this talk, I will project all 140 plates so you can get an impression of the scope of skeletal shapes. You won't have to sit here for that. But if you'd like to mull around and just show them, that's what I'll do. Next slide. In his report, Haeckel remarked, "The skeleton of the radiolaria is developed with such exceedingly manifold and various shapes and exhibits at the same time such wonderful regularity and delicacy in its adjustments that in both of these respects, the present group of protista excels all other classes in the organic world. For in spite of the fact that the radiolarian organism always remains merely a single cell, it shows the potentiality of the highest complexity to which the process of skeleton formation can be brought by a single cell. When I contemplate the many radiolarial skeletal shapes, I am naturally drawn, because of my mathematical background, to ask whether random and cumulative genetic changes might explain the great variety. Perhaps the most familiar analogy is to snow crystals, which I assume that most of us are familiar with. Snow crystals are the result of random microscopic variations in the seeds that grow the crystals. The apparent complexity is the result of relatively simple physical laws of crystal growth. I suppose someone could claim that God directly created each crystal, but it seems much more reasonable and quite adequate to assume that they grow naturally. Next slide. Another possible analogy is fractal design. Fractals are patterns that result from the repeated application of some very simple design rules with random variations superimposed. Fractal designs have infinite variety, but at the same time, they have a recognizable overall appearance. The shapes that characterize varieties of trees and leaves can be duplicated using fractals. Every fern frond or maple leaf is different, but they have a characteristic underlying fractal design that can be described in a few lines of code. Many of the background landscapes in computer games are designed using fractals and can be quite realistic. Here's a fractal Arctic scene with fractal clouds and icebergs and waves. I've also seen fractal mountain ranges and moonscapes. I conjecture that the radiolarian skeletons arise by some similar random processes acting on the genetic code over time, although I confess I do not know exactly what the underlying natural laws are. I do not see the need to invoke supernatural intervention to account for the huge variation. All the variation appears to be centered around a central basic body plan. The geometric variations in the radiolaria are the working out of geometric laws of design, like snow crystals and fractals, but richer in the underlying algorithms." Let's change. Carry the question of scope of kinds to a higher level, to the highly complex but also quite varied trilobites. The story of trilobites is so amazing that I am convinced that they are an example of God's providential grace in providing us with a case history to study the issues of creation and natural development. They first appear as a fully developed complex form about 570 million years ago. They have no plausible fossil ancestor. They are among the earliest hard-bodied fossils to appear, and they vanish around 300 million years later. Let's talk first about the basic body plan. Throughout the entire history of trilobites, this basic plan is constant. It is the earliest fossil that has fully developed eyes, but that's only part of the amazing features of the creature. A trilobite has a hard exoskeleton. The name comes from the fact that the main body, the thorax, has a number of three-part segments. There's one, two, three. The soft parts are protected by an articulated shell, it can bend, which is like armor plate that flexes between the segments, unlike a turtle shell, for example. Each segment has a pair of jointed legs and gills tucked between the legs and the plate. The animal may, not all do, have segmented antennas and compound eyes in the head. We will say more about the eyes shortly. Next slide. The internal features include a full digestive system, a respiratory system with gills, a circulatory system with a heart, muscles, a nervous system with a brain, a nerve cord and ganglia, and various sensor systems, most notably including the compound eyes. And all of this appears suddenly in the fossil record fully formed. Next slide. You might well ask, how do we know the internal structure of the trilobite, since we only have fossils to go by and the internal anatomy is all soft body parts? The answer is, in my view, another example of God's gracious providence. This is a quote. some trilobites discovered near Rome, New York, have had the hard and soft body parts replaced by finely crystalline pyrite. They display finely detailed external appendages and gills. X-rays reveal fine details of muscular, digestive, circulatory, and visual systems. As a result of this providential gift, much is known about trilobite anatomy despite the fact that they have been extinct for 250 million years. Pyrite is known as fool's gold because of its golden color. The soft body parts of these pyritized fossils show up in X-rays of the fossils. This discovery of pyritized fossils offers an extraordinary opportunity to learn about trilobite anatomy. The author calls it providential. I agree. There is no room whatsoever to postulate a gradual evolutionary development of the trilobite body plan. It's just there right from the start in the animal record. Trilobites persist for over 300 million years. Most of them were bottom feeders, although a few varieties appear from their streamlined form to have been swimmers. During this time, trilobites assume a fantastic array of body shapes and features, coming in sizes ranging from thousands of an inch to tens of inches. If you look at the examples over there, there's the one remarkable one that's 15, 16 inches long, something like that. An amazing range of body features appear to come and go over this 300 million year span. And this is just some various examples from different eras. Next slide. The trilobite eye provides a marvelous example of the kind of change that can be seen over this long possible record. First, I should note, the trilobite eye is unique in the animal kingdom. Instead of being made of soft protein, as is the case for all other species, the trilobite has compound eyes of precisely oriented, clear crystals of silicate. The focus is fixed and cannot be changed, unlike the human eye, which can vary the focus with eye muscles, except I must ruefully note, when you grow old in the building, the focus begins to fail. There are two fundamentally different types of trilobite eyes. The holochrol eye, that's the whole skin eye, most trilobites, all the early ones, had an eye made up of many hexagonal cones of clear silicon that directed light down the axis to an optic receptor. Compound eyes are compact hexagonal prisms packed tightly in an arc or bulbous fashion, and each cone in the compound eye could see directly along the cone axis. Thus, a compound eye could see over a range of directions limited by the number and orientation of the cones. In some species, the eyes were on stalks, so they could aim the cones to see over a range of directions. A compound eye may have as few as 30 or as many as 15,000 separate prisms. And I have an example of a stalked one right here, which Dr. Lilly can certainly explain, I'm sure, better than I. And if you look closely at the eyes, you'll see different kinds of eyes among those samples there. Secondly, the schizochoral eye. One group of trilobites, the phacops, which appear late in the Devonian era, had a very different kind of eye lens called the schizochoral, consisting of small, roundish compound lenses rather than long prisms. The upper part of the compound lens was silica, but the lower part was another material with slightly different optical properties, possibly proteins. The purpose of this compound lens was to focus the light into a concentrated spot, much as modern compound microscopic lenses do. The two lenses, lens pieces with different indices of refraction joined to correct for spherical aberrations, an annoying effect that is corrected by modern compound lenses. Each lens assembled is separate from its neighbor by an opaque wall to prevent the scattering of light. Next slide. There were two designs for these lenses. One design used a spherically shaped upper surface, and the other design used an oval upper surface. Remarkably, work by René Descartes and Christopher Huygens in the 1600s solved the spherical aberration problem exactly the same way as the phacops trilobites did 300 million years before. So you have Descartes' lens, which has a spherical surface, and Huygens' lens, which has a, I can't figure that, oval or hyperbolic. It looks almost hyperbolic, but whatever it is, I admit I did not check it out, except it's not spherical. Next slide. And you'll notice that the purpose of the inside being curved is to encourage the light to focus at a point. One obvious question is, how did trilobites come up with the two major versions of crystalline eyes? And what kind of genetic changes were required to do this? At first, the exquisite optimal design of the schizochoral eye might incline a person to believe that this is a great example of fiat creation by God. But the surprising answer, to me at least, is that the eye probably came about by natural random changes in the eye design. Both kinds of trilobite eyes were present in the genetic code all the time, from the very first. All trilobite eyes begin in the embryonic stage as a more or less spherical shape, which grows into the prismatic crystals as the trilobite matures. So it appears that in phacops, this embryonic lens persists through adulthood, whereas in other species, the embryonic lens grows into the holochoral prism. This arresting of normal embryonic development is called pedomorphosis, the retention of embryonic or juvenile features. I first encountered the term as an explanation of the difference between human skulls and the skulls of other primates. The human skull represents an earlier stage of maturation, so in effect, the human skull retains some juvenile features. I must admit, when I first heard this, I was not very favorably impressed. But when you apply the insight to trilobites, it turns into a marvelous demonstration of how the original genetic code for the trilobites can anticipate an eye development that occurs hundreds of millions of years later. This is an second example of genetic anticipation, adding to the armor of the trilobites and crustaceans that existed before they needed it. I believe that even though it seems to be evidence of careful engineering, this remarkable focusing ability is probably the result of natural development. I say this only because I think I could build a computer simulation that would come up with a focused eye with a lens much like Phacops' eye. The random changes would be in developmental genes, the change in the speed of maturation of the eye, for example. The environmental payoff function would be the ability to focus and concentrate the light, thus being able to see effectively in low-light situations, such as moderately deep water, which would increase your grazing range. This would have a direct survival value. I have not actually written such a program, but based on my background with such simulations, I'm confident I could do so. The result would be a demonstration that natural random changes could produce an optimally focusing eye. But note what I am saying. I would start with all the necessary genes to produce the crystals. I'm not making up novel kinds of genes, only slowing up or speeding up the rate of development. Everything else is already there in the toolbox. I went into this extended discussion of trilobites to make some points about what the fossil record says about the creation process. I think a few points are worth making. It seems, first note, that the complex body plan, including sexual reproduction, the full gut, circulatory system, nervous system, and so forth, arose in complete form at the start. It seems particularly interesting that the eye, which must be one of the most complex of sensory developments, appears right from the first. If all the remarks about pedomorphosis are accurate, it would seem that all the genetic code to cover the variations of the trilobites were present from the first. This essentially says that God created the genetic code for the trilobites, then natural processes produced the variations. This is not to say God could not have intervened, but it may be possible to show the changes over time were already provided for in the first species. An example of something that might be achieved by natural processes is the schizochoral lens. But I do not think the genetic code needed for the eye's very existence can by any means be had without an intelligent designer. On the contrary, I believe the genetic code for the trilobite from the very first included everything needed. Next slide. The problem solved by plants and animals is not just solved in one or a few adequate ways, but in a multitude of ways, and often with great cleverness and ingenuity. In so many ways that some have suggested that nature displays every possible solution and every variation of the solution to the problem. Before Darwin came on the scene, it was commonly understood as a point of theology that God created all possible forms of life. That was part of God's glory displayed in nature. The French biologist Georges Cuvier argued in the early 1800s that nature shows, quote, all combinations that are not incoherent, unquote, a form of a long-existing doctrine of plenitude. Of course, since Darwin, such an explanation has fallen into disfavor, but it has recently been reasserted by Michael Denton in his marvelous book, Nature's Destiny, which I have a copy here. I don't think you'll be able to read it completely tonight yet, in which he devotes a fascinating chapter to just this point. He gives many examples. All possible body forms, all possible eyes, all possible organism sizes, all possible methods to achieve respiration, circulation, and movement. I urge everyone to get a hold of the book and read at least that one chapter. Regarding the example of all possible eyes, he wrote, quote, "It appears that every possibility has been realized in the design of image-forming optical devices." He follows this up with a chapter on the eye of the lobster. We've already seen some of the variation in our discussion of trilobite eyes. You would have amorphous, hard and soft, and crystalline lenses, simple and compound eyes, focusing and non-focusing, reflective and refractive, simple and compound lenses with multiple refractive indices, image formation by focusing and by scanning, a myriad of non-image-forming light sensors, sensitivity to various parts of the light spectrum, and even passive and active light eyes. There are actually some species that generate the light that they see by, which I find almost unbelievable. Don't ask me what species. I just know it happens. It does not seem to be an exaggeration to say, with Denton, that every sort of engineering solution to the problem of vision can be found in nature. Think of any detail of biology, and you will find a comprehensive array of solutions distributed among the various species of light. These solutions are not only found in the so-called higher plants. Even the most humble species solve the life problems in exceedingly ingenious ways. Next slide, please. I hope that this brief talk has given you some notion of the great and marvelous story of God's creation of plants and animals that he has placed in the fossil record. The story is one of a creation that prepares the environment and then fills it with plants and animals that are suited for the environment that he has prepared. The story of populating the dry land with plants and animals shows a gradual move to dry land that began in water, moved to swamps and shorelines, and finally moved inland to dry land, preparing the food and the species for each step. This orderly plan does not prove random undirected evolution any more than the orderly plan for a large construction project proves that there were no blueprints. But God did not just leave us with this orderly record. He also gives fossil evidence that the most complex body plans arose suddenly in the record without logical precursors or an orderly progression of complexity. This is what one would expect from a creator. It is not what one would expect from random undirected evolution. In God's creation of body plans, there is evidence that the plans anticipated future needs or developments that were not present when they first show up in the record. Examples are armor and provision for the compound eyes. With an adequate gene pool, natural change can produce an astonishing range of body shapes and features. Examples we have seen include the radiolarian skeletons and the trilobite eyes. Of course, many other examples could be cited, which has led to Michael Denton and others to assert that animals use every way to solve the problems of life. Finally, although we did not dwell on the point, the fossil and geological history illustrates the fact that a stable ecosystem of plants and animals requires that all byproducts of life must be recycled, or the system breaks down eventually. We could point out examples in the carbon deposits in the Carboniferous age, in which carbon was not effectively recycled, and the age of dinosaurs, in which large animals dominated the land. Finally, I hope that you agree that the nonsense question is a reasonable thing to ask, and that seeking to answer it will provide much insight into how creation occurs. From what I can determine, there remains a lot of work to be done to answer it. I believe the answer can be found by a careful examination of God's fossil record of the creative activity and a deep understanding of genetics and embryonic development. I believe that God intends us to find the answers, and that it's for us to do the hard, honest, scientific work to get them. Thank you. Anybody have any questions or comments you'd like to pose? Yes.
All this information, I've been trying to do my own research in the whole creation.
Yeah.
And the evidence that I've seen is so persuasive as to render evolution almost obsolete. And yet it's still the majority view, obviously, and I was just
asking, yeah.
What would a secular evolutionary scientist say to some of the arguments you just produced?
Well, that's a good question. All I can say is that there are a number, I can think of a half dozen, of books that have recently been written by people who were basically evolutionists who say, hey, there's a big problem with evolution. Most of the evolutionists, you know, I am not in, you know, I don't sit at the conferences and so forth and so on. But most of the evolutionists I hear are the popular press kind of guys, like Jay Gould and Richard Dawkins and so forth and so on. And, you know, from my perspective, they just basically don't want to believe anything other than their position. They're sort of like in my view. And, you know, I don't dispute their honest scientific work when they're doing scientific work. But their interpretations, in my view, sometimes either overlook important stuff. For example, Jay Gould just blows over genetic information. It's just like it didn't exist. Lynn Margulis, the Five Kingdoms, she basically blows over genetic findings as if it didn't exist. You know, she's all physical appearance, morphology. You know, at least, and I'm probably being unjust, but that's the way that it seems to me. I can't say much more. Some of the people, Bart.
I'll just add to that. I mean, I think that there's a tremendous faith exhibited in the robustness of theory to explain life as we see it. There is validity as an organizing principle in biology because it allowed one to make predictions and those predictions to hold up. And so there is some utility as sort of an operational principle, even though there are problems with that principle. Okay, and you know I think back and Michael Behe wrote a book, Darwin's Block, Black Box, Biochemical Challenge to Evolution, and there were a number of people who wrote reviews of that book, and one of the reviews that appeared in Scientific American was pretty enlightening. Actually, it was a New Scientist, which is a British kind of equivalent to Scientific American, and in it the individual who looked at the arguments that were raised by Behe acknowledged that they were robust and sound and presented a serious challenge to the current formulation of theory. And but he simply said that he was very disappointed that, you know, after Behe did his analysis, he basically then invoked the idea of a creator, okay, a designer for this thing, and sort of chastised and castigated him for not simply kind of using, you know, creating a whip and basically whipping the evolutionists and saying, you know, the point is true. If evolution is true, it must work at a molecular level to the same extent that it works at the organismal level. And your theories and your evidence doesn't do that, so find the evidence and show us why it's right. So you see, you know, he even though he wrote a really interesting critique and he acknowledged the value of what he raised and the problems that he pointed out, he simply was saying that anything other than, you know, a theory, a naturalistic theory of evolution is an unacceptable solution.
Yeah, there is a point of view that it's just not science. If it doesn't have a natural explanation, it's not science. And so you can't pose a question that you can't answer in science. It's not a science question. Well, you know. Oh yeah.
Pretty little you can do with science.
Yeah.
Is science a game to explain things by naturalistic means, or is science an attempt to find out how things really are?
Yes.
Well, if naturalism is right, those two merge. If naturalism is wrong, those are two quite different projects. And what we're suggesting here is there's evidence in nature that these are two different projects.
Yes. Yeah. Frankly, my personal heart desire is to encourage Christians to think about the facts of science and how that relates to their understanding of God's creative activity. I don't have the contact with the secular world to push the other agenda. People like Philip Johnson and Michael B. I mean, I respect them tremendously because that is their ministry, basically, their mission. Honestly, I won't say it's not my mission, but it's just, I just don't have the contacts with people to really find out what people are really thinking and how to answer them effectively. But I am very concerned, which most Christians who are scientific thinkers should be concerned with, how the church takes these things, because it can become almost a, it's like almost like a counterculture in some circles to be pushing an old earth point of view in the face of the very loud and insistent press towards a very literal young earth point of view, which in my view just is not scientifically respectable, personally, from my point of view. Yes?
I like very much your nonsense question. And, you know, what you alluded to in your talk, you know, about establishing the limits of diversity or the limits of natural variation, and your reference to now this understanding and developmental biology of Hox genes and some of these regulatory elements within the genetic code that actually coordinately control development of large features. It's an area that's very exciting in the cutting edge of developmental biology as new information is coming out daily with regards to this. And it's going to be interesting to see the play that goes on within the research journals and academic journals, because the evidence that is emerging does indeed suggest that there are limits, that, you know, these particular developmental genes control very specific programs. And, you know, the questions that Beatty raised at a biochemical level, you know, with this idea of irreducible complexity, are going to be replayed at another level above that, as you talk about how these very complex, very intricate, very carefully controlled patterns of gene expression that go on, how they could have risen by random acts, when indeed, you know, the regulatory genes have nothing to control until the subset,
until there is something there to control.
Until the subsets need to be organized. So, you know, again, when we try to do this backward stuff, we run into a number of roadblocks, and so it'll be interesting to see what develops. But I do think that at some point we will come closer to an answer to the question that you proposed, and that is that there are some distinct limits within what we would call simply fully naturalistic processes.
Yeah, and if that doesn't include all of creation, then the next question is, okay, how did you get everything?
How do you jump the gaps?
Yeah, how do you jump the gaps? Yeah, and you know, I would claim I do not believe in the God of the gaps, just because I don't know the explanation God must have done. I view it as, hey, that's a very interesting question. But I will tell you, if you're telling me you've got to create 300 genes with very specific things interacting, and it's got to be done, randomly, then as a mathematician, I say to myself, no way, no way. I don't care how many billions of years you have. There's no way you're going to do that. Now, if you say, I'm going to start with the genes for the trilobite, and now I'm going to produce a holocrolli and a schizocrolli, personally, I think I could write a computer program that would do that, because I can see a payoff function. I can see, you know, I can see, and I can imagine, you know, just small random changes in the development process which take hold and become a new species. I can kind of visualize that, but I can't visualize getting all the genes for making an eye, just from nothing. That's where I tend to see the dividing line.
So another way to say is that you can devise means by which information, once it exists, can be manipulated to create diversity.
Yes.
But generating the information from scratch is still one of the stumbling blocks.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I don't want to hold everybody up. I mean,
I'm just intrigued by the use of the word random. I guess, could you explain what you mean by random? And is there any such thing, truly speaking, as a random act, I guess, in the way that you incorporate the uses of that word?
Yeah. Yeah, if a cosmic ray comes pounding into my body and it happens to hit DNA at some place, I have no idea where it's going to hit it. It could hit it anywhere as far as I can see. And it might actually knock out and change one of my genes or one of the codes of my genes. That's what I would call random. There's no way of predicting what's going to happen. And what is the effect of that? Well, it depends on what that gene does and what that particular codon does in the gene. That's what I would be... There is plenty of source of randomness, cosmic rays, just transcription errors, which occur on once in a billion transcriptions, once in a while, that happens. So there is such a thing as randomness. The neat thing is, which is discovered only about 1925, is that mathematicians can describe random processes and come up with laws for random processes. In fact, that was my PhD thesis. If you have lots of things happening, they tend to head towards certain laws, okay? And so when I look at, I think I can see how you can do small things with random chance, but how you make phenomenal coordinated changes with random processes, right? And I just calculate the probabilities and I say, man, oh man, never in a billion universes. Yeah, that's sort of thing. Yes.
I admit my ignorance to the subject.
So I'm ignorant too. You're part of us.
Asking a question that probably everybody in the room is way ahead of me, whatever, but I have no presuppositions. So this is just sort of a fresh question. But with figures like 300 million, 40 billion, things like this, I'm curious to know, why would you put stock in dating systems like carbon dating or whatever? Like I said, I'm totally against the subject. Why put
stock on that? Well, I'll tell you specifically carbon dating, or not carbon dating, but radioactive dating more generally. I'm a physicist. I mean, I have a lot of training in physics. And I understand the experiments that can be used to calculate half-lives of radioactive material. And I think I understand why they do decay at a certain rate. And so all I require to believe radioactive statements about what half-lives and so forth are, all I require is somebody, some physicist, to design a cold-blooded experiment where we just look at the stuff and measure something. And if I can see this guy here can do it, and that guy way over there without knowing what this guy's answer was can do it, and somebody way over there can do the same thing and come up with the same answer, then I tend to believe as a physicist that that's a physical constant. That's something that really happens. And in the case of radioactive decay, uranium in particular, they have lifeline. I think uranium is 2 billion years, 4 billion years, something like that. Those are numbers that are very precisely measured by cold-blooded experiments, no opinion involved in them, just measuring numbers. And they come up with numbers like that. And so I didn't believe that, because I'm a physicist. When I see a cold-blooded experiment described, and the results are consistent by a person who has no vested interest in this, and another one, then I tend to believe the results. There's thousands and millions of these. If I pick up if somebody says, here's a chunk of rock, I want you to date it, and I can do a scientific experiment, which we don't just use one radioactive decay, we use a whole bunch of them, and then compare them, now they are they consistent or not. And it was, 10 or 15 different measurements, they all come up 4.62 plus or minus 5 million years, billion years, 4.2 billion plus or minus 5 million. And I said, well, I think that's, and I sent it over to another laboratory to come up with something fairly similar, and I say that's probably right. So when they date moon rocks, for example, that's exactly what they do. Nobody said this has got to be 4 billion years old. They actually just measure the isotopes of uranium and so forth, and that's what they come up with. And I tend to believe that.
Are there more than just the radioactive system? Okay.
Oh, there's many ways. For dating things, there's a number of ways, depending on how long you're asking to go.
Are there, in fact, disagreements between scientists and evolutionists?
In the dating?
Right.
I don't. Science is a big deal. I'm sure there's somebody that disagrees with almost anything. But I think it's pretty uniform agreement among physicists and physicists despise biologists. A lower grade of animal in the first place. But and mathematicians despise everybody. I find it. What I'm hoping is somebody, some kid, who says, hey, this sounds like a great career. Because I think there's so much needs to be done. So much. It's incredible. I call it my 500-year project. So I'm expecting to be working on this in heaven for another 495 years. I don't know, 475.
Yes. Because another thing to mention about that is that, you know, the closer you are to present, the more independent you need there are to establish dates and various types of materials, depending on whether those materials have organic matter or once alive or whether they were not. And also the degree of precision with which things can be dated. They can be dated, if they are closer to present, they can be dated with much greater precision than if they're tremendously old. And yet the fact of a loss of precision as we go back does not necessarily mean that the ballpark figures aren't reasonably correct. So, you know, I wouldn't live or die on a day in the universe as being 20 billion years old or the day of the Earth being 4 billion years old. But I'll tell you, dates going back a few hundred thousand years are extremely precise and reliable and can be verified by multiple mechanisms, not only radiometric, but by various non-radiometric methods. And so I think that, you know, one has to kind of, when you're thinking about the question of the age or so on, you need to kind of draw some things. No matter, I think, how you sort it out, you're going to come up with, you know, a very high degree of probability that what we see as physical matter around us certainly exists back into the millions of years. Whether it's billions or not, I mean, we can debate and dispute those kinds of things. I think that you're going to be really hard-pressed to try to make a very convincing and compelling model that says the Earth is less than 100,000 years old. And so, you know, when you need to try to discuss certain things or to look at different viewpoints, I think you need to kind of take those grand schemes into consideration. So, you know, a proper young Earth model is probably going to include at least a few hundred thousand years in the model if it's going to be consistent with the physical evidence of the created universe. And it's going to be very, very hard. And what happens, at least from my reading of young Earth creationists, when they try to deal with the question of age, they apply a lot of assumptions about the way in which changes occurred in radioactive decay times and light travel times and so forth in order to try to compensate for the fact that a real honest scientific investigation will not yield numbers low enough to be consistent with those views.
And that makes me itchy because when I look at astronomy and we're measuring stuff way back and they have the same decay, the same spectrum for hydrogen no matter how far you go back, so how could the speed of light have changed?
And so, yeah, I think that there's changes.
I mean, I've heard that makes a lot of sense to you, right?
those things are a challenge. So, I mean, you know, within the context, you know, of people who are discussing these kind of things, I would like to see sort of a coming together and meeting of minds. I think, you know, older creationists, I think, have a sense that there is legitimate science out there that needs to be reconciled. After all, God has chosen to reveal himself not only through, you know, special revelation and what was in Scripture is, but also through what has been made. Right? We find that in multiple places within the context of Scripture. So we can't just routinely or easily discount observations, especially if they're made with great care, that appear not to fit with certain presumptions we have about interpretation of text.